The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Nations scurry to beat back the Omicron variant. Some places like Israel are totally shutting out travelers. For tour guides there, that's bad news.
There were so many people that had been really, really eager to come, and they booked their tickets and they were really excited. And then we pull the rug out from under them and say, oh, now you can't come anymore.
Also today, the world's biggest film market, China. The box office boom is partly driven by Chinese propaganda movies. Hollywood's paying close attention.
I think Hollywood needs China a lot more than China needs Hollywood right now.
And when it comes to China and one-star tennis player, the Women's Tennis Association, the WTA, took a firm stand today.
What the WTA has done has put morals before money.
It's suspending play in China as concerns grow over tennis player Peng Shuai. That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Yesterday, the Omicron variant of the coronavirus was detected in the U.S. for the first time. Today, President Biden outlined his latest pandemic strategy, and part of that new approach, more home testing. Biden announced that Americans with private health insurance will be able to get reimbursed for those tests. In most of Europe, rapid home tests are already part of everyday life, and they're free. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Oksana Pizik. She's a global health advisor and a lecturer at University College London. So home tests in the U.S., Oksana, are pretty much only available at drugstores, and they cost between $10 and $20 for a box. How easy is it to get a rapid COVID-19 test in London, where you are?
Well, you can get a free rapid test at any pharmacy across the entire country. So very widespread, very easy to access because it's free.
And how are home tests actually being used in the daily lives of Brits?
This is part of daily life in terms of going to work, going to social events. Early in the summer, even, we had the prime minister call for the population to do these at-home tests that give you a very quick result within 15 minutes, twice a week. And now that effort has ramped up even further. Also, there are employer requirements. It's also part of student life in order to enter a classroom. So really widespread application.
Remind us, Oksana, why frequent testing is one of the keys to getting the pandemic under control and why President Biden is pushing hard on this.
We are able to catch many more cases than otherwise would be possible if we do at-home tests. If you have a positive result, then that triggers sending it off for a PCR to confirm. And rapid tests can quickly identify around 98% of infectious cases, even though they're not as sensitive as PCR tests. So you're casting the net wide, and as a result, you break chains of transmission and infection that otherwise wouldn't get picked up.
And 98% is pretty good. How does that compare to the PCR test, which does take several days to get a result from?
So PCR tests take anywhere between 48 to 72 hours, depending on the speed of the companies that provide them. PCR are both more sensitive and more specific. So you're looking at 99% plus range. It also is key because with PCR, we're able to detect the genetic material of the virus. So the rapid tests detect certain proteins that trigger the production of antibodies. So that we can affirm is positive, but we wouldn't know if it was for the Omicron variant or other variants. Whereas PCR, we can actually track those variants that are in circulation, which is, of course, now with the emergence of Omicron is incredibly important.
Mm. So as far as rapid home tests go, you said in the UK, they're widely available and free. What about in other parts of Europe?
Well, in Germany, they cost about a dollar. In other European countries, they're free. South Korea was one of the first countries to introduce mass testing and made it widely available to the public at no cost, and many other parts of Asia as well. So it's been readily embraced as a more holistic strategy rather than solely relying on vaccines.
In the U.S., there are about 12 FDA-approved home COVID-19 tests, and I've read there's close to 100 in the European Union. What's behind that dramatic difference?
Well, the FDA has been very restrictive in terms of the standards for these tests. And given that it's just a diagnostic tool and not something that you have to take or put into your body, is a bit strange. Europe and UK have allowed for a faster application process as well as less stringent requirements. And given how important testing is as a tool, I think that's the right way to go.
President Biden's plan includes making home rapid tests available to lower-income Americans at clinics across the country. What do you think of his reimbursement approach for Americans who have private health insurance?
The reimbursement model will be one of the weakest points of trying to roll out a mass testing strategy because people need it to be easy, and reimbursement model is not easy. It doesn't mirror the success of what we have seen in UK, Europe, and parts of Asia. In order for people to be using it regularly, it really has to come either free of cost or in another way that doesn't become more burdensome than it already is with all the other COVID restrictions.
Oksana Pizik is a global health advisor and lecturer at University College London. Oksana, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Israel closed its borders to travelers last weekend following the first news of the Omicron variant. The impact on tourism was immediate. One Israeli who's feeling that is tour guide Joel Haber. He came to Israel from the U.S. more than a decade ago and has been giving tours throughout the country through his outfit, Fun Joel's Israel Tours. Joel joins us now from Jerusalem. Joel, the Omicron news came so suddenly last week and the closure to foreign travel hit just as Hanukkah was beginning. How did that affect your tour business? Were things starting to pick up again after a tough 20 months or so?
Yeah, so Israel just opened widely to tourists at the beginning of November. So I noticed an immediate uptick in requests for tours. And then all of a sudden, a number of them had to cancel because they couldn't even get into the country.
This is not the first time authorities have restricted travel into Israel. What have you done in the past when visitors stopped coming?
You know, I guess using the buzzword of the times, I did a major pivot pretty much right from the beginning. I started to do things online, so virtual tours and online lectures, freelance writing, stuff of that nature. And then, you know, just waiting whenever tourists were able to come back, I did it.
Do you have any opinion on Israel's restrictions, closing its borders to travelers?
No, so I don't have an opinion specifically on whether they should or should not have closed the borders. One of the bad things that definitely will come out of this is that we're losing a lot of the goodwill that we have with those who want to come here. We had been closed to most tourists for months, and finally, they got the opportunity and said, it's open. And there were so many people that had been really, really eager to come, and they booked their tickets and they were really excited. And then we pull the rug out from under them and say, oh, now you can't come anymore. And that's going to, you know, upset a lot of people that were favorably disposed towards us. The other thing, though, is that we don't have a choice. The fact that I haven't worked wasn't my choice. They closed the airports. And therefore, the government needed, in my opinion, and still needs to take better care of the tour guides, the hotels, tour agencies, all of us that have been affected, not by our choice. And that's something that can be done.
We're in the midst of Hanukkah, of course. Christmas is also a very busy time of year in the Holy Land, generally.
Yep.
So for those of us, Joel, who are travel starved, where would you have taken visitors to show off Jerusalem?
Unlike in the States where, you know, you have Jews living all over in random places and you might be able to walk past their house and see some menorahs, some Hanukkah lights in their windows, here, because the majority of population is Jewish, they're everywhere. We put them outside, sometimes in front of our houses. In certain neighborhoods, particularly the neighborhood where I live, which is right next to the market, it's really beautiful just to walk around in the neighborhood at night and see all of the lights and see all the different styles of menorahs and people outside singing. It's a really, really beautiful atmosphere. So that's something that's special for Hanukkah, as well as going around and sampling some of the donuts that are very common here as a celebratory food. That's also something that makes a lot of people happy.
Joel Haber runs Fun Joel's Israel Tours. He was speaking with us about the impact of travel restrictions on tourism in Jerusalem. Joel, thank you very much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
The Women's Tennis Association has suspended all of its tournaments in China over concerns for the safety of star Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai, a decision that will reportedly cost the WTA nearly $1 billion. Peng accused a former senior leader of the Communist Party in China of forcing her into a sexual relationship. In the month since then, she's disappeared from public life. The world's Bianca Hillier has the latest.
The WTA's move makes them one of just a few organizations to push back on China.
What the WTA has done has put morals before money.
Yan Bennett is a former U.S. diplomat and is now the assistant director of the Center on Contemporary China at Princeton University. She says suspending tournaments is an appropriate and necessary step.
They regard her safety and the whole issue of gender equality more important than, you know, how much money they make in China.
The move is also welcomed by human rights advocates who have been demanding action for weeks. Andrea Florence is the acting director of the Sports and Rights Alliance, a coalition of sports unions and human rights organizations.
We hope that China is going to be able to answer and ensure Peng safety and also an investigation into her allegations if she so desires.
Today, the Chinese Tennis Association expressed its, quote, indignation and firm opposition to the WTA's decision, adding that it was made based on, quote, fictitious information. State-run media also said it didn't really matter if the tournaments were suspended, because COVID-19 could have canceled them anyway. Still, many are now waiting to see if other sports governing bodies, like the NBA or the Men's Pro Tennis Association, the ATP, will also withdraw from China. The ATP did not reply to a request for comment, but pro tennis player Tennis Sandgren is one of a growing number of athletes who says the ATP should follow in the WTA's footsteps.
I think everybody should. I think the ATP definitely should. I don't think we should have tournaments there, least of all until this is cleared up.
In the WTA statement, CEO Steve Simon said, quote, "While we now know where Peng is, I have serious doubts that she is free and safe," end quote. The tennis pro was last seen in Beijing on November 21st after she'd made the allegation. In a video posted on Twitter, Peng is shown at a youth tennis tournament. She waves to empty stands and signs autographs. That same day, the International Olympic Committee also spoke with Peng, who has competed in three summer games.
They said it was a very cordial call and friendly call.
Longtime IOC member Dick Pound was not on the call, but he says of all the people who were trying to reach Peng, he isn't surprised she decided to connect with fellow Olympians.
All of the people involved in the meeting are Olympians, so there's a bond there that is easily accessed and easily felt.
The IOC says they also spoke with Peng yesterday. They did not release any details of the call, except that she appeared to be safe and well. Many people continue to doubt that and are criticizing the IOC for not mentioning her sexual assault allegations. But Dick Pound says he has, quote, "absolutely no idea why people are questioning the IOC's statements and continuing to ask if Peng is safe."
Frankly, I would rather rely on people who are actually on the call rather than accusations from people who were not there.
China, meanwhile, has remained largely silent. Yan Bennett from Princeton University says Peng's accusation is an indirect criticism of the government, one that Beijing wants to stop in its tracks.
Generally, if China doesn't want to respond to anything, they just don't answer. You know, they'll try and pretend like nothing happened.
Bennett says these tactics typically work to control the narrative inside of China's borders. But this time around, she thinks China underestimated the international repercussions. Now, the WTA's move could create momentum.
What would be helpful at this point is a similar reaction from the American government, announcing a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics.
So far, senators from Kansas, Florida, Texas, and Tennessee have applauded the WTA, while the White House has yet to comment. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Remember all the talk at the Glasgow Climate Conference about fossil fuels? Coming up, why some countries keep subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, even when they agree they shouldn't. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow last month, nearly 200 countries agreed to phase out subsidies for fossil fuels. Those subsidies are widely seen as blocking the way to a transition to cleaner energy. World leaders have made similar pledges in the past, but little has changed. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports on why subsidies for coal, oil, and natural gas are so hard to kick, and what this latest agreement could mean.
The UN estimates governments spend an average of $423 billion a year on fossil fuel subsidies. That's tax breaks or price caps at the pump that make it cheaper to produce or buy coal, oil, or gas.
That's a definition of insanity.
At last month's climate summit, U.S. climate envoy John Kerry argued subsidies worked against everything leaders were trying to do there.
We're allowing to feed the very problem we're here to try to cure.
Kerry's counterpart from the Marshall Islands, Tina Stege, agreed.
Fossil fuel subsidies are paying for our own destruction.
By the end of the summit, 197 countries had adopted a text that agreed to phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. The mention of fossil fuels in the text was a first in the 25-year history of the UN climate talks.
It's very significant.
Ipek Genjsu is a researcher at the London-based Overseas Development Institute.
So the fact that the world fossil fuels are in there is a major achievement, and the fact that they're committing to phase out their subsidies is a major achievement.
But the agreement calls only for the phase-out of inefficient subsidies, which significantly weakens the pledge. For one thing, there's no definition of what inefficient means, says Genjsu.
Governments have hidden behind this word in the past. So G20 countries made a similar commitment back in 2009, and so far the progress has not been very good.
In the U.S., oil and gas companies say tax incentives for exploration and drilling are essential to keeping low-cost domestic energy flowing. But critics, which include the UN, the International Monetary Fund, and the International Energy Agency, say the subsidies just encourage more development of fuels that need to be phased out. Bronwyn Tucker is with the research and advocacy organization Oil Change International.
Basically, we should not be building new wells at this point, which means taking the extra step of using public money to help build those wells is kind of extra ridiculous.
In developing countries, subsidies often help make electricity or gas for cars cheaper for consumers. Energy economist Vibhuti Garg says in India, electricity was subsidized by $18 billion last year. Garg works for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. She says those subsidies have helped electrify rural households that used to rely on kerosene lamps for light.
So definitely such consumers need subsidized power.
But these subsidies actually help wealthier people the most because they use more electricity.
So that kind of blanket subsidy being given to everyone should be done away with, and subsidies should be targeted better.
But no politician wants energy prices to increase on their watch. And abruptly removing subsidies has triggered backlash in the past. In 2012, Nigeria saw a nationwide strike after removing gas subsidies, as reported here by Al Jazeera.
Nigeria's commercial hub, Lagos, witnesses a second day of protests following the doubling of fuel prices overnight.
Street protests erupted in Ecuador in 2019 for the same reason. It's going to be hard for national governments to make good on last month's pledge in Glasgow to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. The pact doesn't include a time frame or any enforcement mechanism. It does, however, give environmental groups additional leverage. That's according to University of Eastern Finland climate law professor Haro Fanasalt.
So they have an international commitment that they can use to influence government policy to try and implement reform.
Like many international promises, the key here will be how or if the pledge to phase out fossil fuel subsidies translates to national policies.
It's absolutely important. But do I think that this will immediately drive any country to start implementing reform? No.
For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Chile's presidential election is coming up later this month. The far-right candidate José Antonio Kast appears to be the frontrunner. He's proposed digging a ditch along the border to stop migrants from illegally entering Chile. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
José Antonio Kast, in his days since his victory in Chile's first round of presidential voting, has been traveling far and wide. He's been giving press conferences, talking to voters, and this week he flew all the way to the United States.
Vengo saliendo de una muy buena reunión con el senador Rubio aquí en el Capitolio en Washington D.C., Estados Unidos.
Kast met with Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. He talked about it in a campaign video he recorded in front of the U.S. Capitol building.
Ha sido una gran jornada y los invito.
It's been a big day, Kast said. He said he was in Washington to promote Chilean democracy and trade. Claudia Heiss is a political scientist at the Universidad de Chile in Santiago.
He's trying to give the impression that he's going to the U.S. to give some guarantees to the markets, to show himself very presidential in the first world.
Gass said his campaign had not reached out to the Biden administration or any Democrats, only to like-minded leaders. Heiss says that's consistent with Gass' platform.
I would describe it as an extreme right-wing platform, very conservative, Catholic conservative in moral terms.
Gass opposes gay marriage and the legalization of abortion. He supports free trade and opposes multilateral organizations, Heiss says.
He says that the United Nations and other international programs are left-wing centers of brainwashing of people and indoctrination.
Gass has successfully branded himself as an outsider, but he's been in politics for decades. He's a lawyer, a former member of Congress with one of Chile's biggest parties, and he became an independent only 2 years ago when he founded his own party, the Republican Party, to run for the presidency. Heiss explains that Gast also has philosophical and family connections to the administration of former dictator Augusto Pinochet.
He said that Pinochet was not a real dictator. He took over power in a moment of emergency in Chile to prevent communism, and he peacefully and democratically gave back power after he lost the plebiscite in 1988, and there were no people in prison at that time.
Which is demonstrably false. Pinochet took over in a bloody military coup in 1973 and left behind more than 40,000 victims of government violence when he relinquished power in 1990. Marianne Gonzalez teaches legal history at the Universidad de Chile in Santiago. She says that Gass's popularity shows many Chileans have long been sympathetic toward the dictatorship.
This is the historical DNA of the right wing, and it's very easy for them to reconnect with that.
In his campaign, Gass capitalizes on a relatively new issue for Chile, migration. The country has seen exponential growth in numbers of migrants from Venezuela, Haiti, and other countries. That has resulted in widespread anti-immigrant sentiment and violence.
He has developed this very patriotic, very nationalistic discourse of protecting Chile, both from the outside and protecting Chile from the internal sort of dangers.
Chile's Congress is roughly divided between liberals and conservatives. So either Gast or his opponent, the former student leader Gabriel Boric, would have a difficult task ahead. But González says that if Gast wins the presidency, Chile's conservative establishment would be taking a radical move to the right. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You're listening to The World. The snow leopard thrives in one of the harshest climates on Earth. There are only about 4,000 of them roaming the mountains of Central Asia. But with less open land, they're coming into more contact with people and COVID.
Clearly, snow leopards are susceptible to getting the disease and also are not very resistant.
COVID and vulnerable big cats coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tensions between Russia and Ukraine are high right now. In recent months, Russia has been moving thousands of troops to its border with Ukraine. Today in Sweden, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Here's Blinken speaking to the press after that meeting.
It's now on Russia to de-escalate the current tensions by reversing the recent troop buildup, returning forces to normal peacetime positions, and refraining from further intimidation and attempts to destabilize Ukraine.
To discuss what's going on, I'm joined by Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at the CNA Research Organization just outside of Washington. Michael, you follow the Russian military really closely. Describe what we know about these troop movements on Ukraine's border.
So the situation has been unfolding actually over the course of the year, going back as far as early March, where there were a series of Russian military deployments with units moving from as far as central Russia, thousands of kilometers away from Ukraine, to the Ukrainian border. Since April, it felt like there was a bit of a de-escalation, but in fact, some of these units stayed in the area and never left. And this fall, there's been a lot of unusual Russian military activity that is, again, a resurgence of Russian troops moving out of garrison, not for regular training or exercises or qualification checks, but instead deploying, you know, relative distance from Ukraine's borders. And increasingly, that force posture looks Like the Russian military has been ordered to prepare for a large-scale military contingency with Ukraine. This is not another war scare. You know, this conflict has seen sort of false war alarms or sort of escalation alarms over the past several years, but this one is much more serious. It's significant. Now, on the one hand, Russia does appear to be engaging in course of diplomacy. They've issued some demands and red lines, but they've clearly set up a military option, the ability to kind of use force to pursue their political aims.
So two questions. What do you think is Russia's objective here?
The position they've laid out is that there are principally two demands. The first is they want to compel Ukraine to change its policy. There's been a political deadlock for over a year. They don't seem to have a clear way forward, at least from a political diplomatic perspective. And the second one has to do with the United States and NATO presence in Ukraine. Now, Russia has long had a red line, stated that formal acceptance of Ukraine into NATO for Moscow is unacceptable. But increasingly, that red line has shifted to NATO defense cooperation, presence of U.S., U.K. forces, training, transfer of certain military capabilities to Ukraine is also not acceptable. That is how the defense relationship with Ukraine is evolving, is very much not to Russian liking. So they've sort of shifted that goalpost. And that's one of their major demands to the United States, one of the points of negotiation between Lavrov and Blinken, I suspect.
I mean, Putin said yesterday that he wants legal guarantees that NATO will not expand further to the east. Is that one of the red lines you're referring to?
Absolutely. But the challenge with that is the United States cannot give guarantees on behalf of NATO. NATO's an alliance of roughly 30 states. So this is a bit of a false opening position. It is just not possible for those to be met. The question is Moscow willing to accept an off-ramp or negotiations or substantive talks about these security concerns enough? I am skeptical. The military deployment that we are witnessing seems grossly out of character and out of proportion for a sort of easy diplomatic off-ramp of that kind.
Secretary Blinken has said that if Russia continues to pursue confrontation, there will be severe economic consequences. He said diplomacy is the best way forward. How would you assess the response from the U.S. and the West generally?
I think the United States faces some tremendous dilemmas here. On the one hand, I think the political and diplomatic approach has been correct in trying to harness a collective response, a common political position with European allies, and try to make credible any course of threats of sort of economic cost that Russia might suffer, political cost that Russia might suffer if it's contemplating a much larger escalation of the conflict. On the other hand, while political support for Ukraine is important, the United States also has to be very cautious. I mean, I think it's increasingly clear to observers that neither NATO or the United States are going to fight Russia over Ukraine. That puts the United States' reputation very much out there. And if it's overtly challenged and the United States doesn't do much to substantiate those commitments, it could have follow-on implications for other commitments to allies and partners. So there's a lot at stake. And there aren't very easy answers. I think that there's a potential for finding some diplomatic resolution with Moscow. But I am also increasingly growing pessimistic.
And why are you pessimistic?
Because there's a strong status quo bias in conflicts of this type, where I think people presume that they're on a natural trajectory towards freezing. But the reality is that when you're dealing with states like Russia, who have extended history and use of force in pursuing their political objectives, when you begin to see a clear recognition on the behalf of that leadership that they start to see this situation as one where a follow-on war is inevitable, they're beginning to ask themselves, if another fight is inevitable, is using force now ultimately cheaper and less costly than using it down the line? And that's the calculus that I'm increasingly beginning to see, at least my perception of it. Ultimately, it's hard to say what the political calculus is in Moscow. Anybody who tells you they can read Vladimir Putin's mind is probably trying to sell you something. But the truth is that the trajectory right now is worrisome and increasingly ominous.
Michael Kaufman, the director of Russia Studies at the CNA Research Organization, speaking with us about Russian troop buildup on Ukraine's border. Michael, thank you very much for your thoughts.
No, thanks for having me on your program.
Across Western China and Central Asia, you will find the snow leopard. More infrequently, however, because they're a vulnerable population, and today even more at risk. Some of the same things plaguing humans now also threaten snow leopards, namely climate change and COVID. From northern Kyrgyzstan, Levi Bridges has a story.
The farming village of Selkin Tor is just a small collection of houses. Cows amble along muddy, unpaved streets. And in the background, the towering, snow-covered peaks of the Tian Shan Mountains pierce into a blue sky. The landscape here kind of looks like Colorado, but everything feels like twice as big. Forty-seven-year-old Alim Saltavat keeps about 10 head of cattle here. He's also got horses, a massive flock of sheep, and four little dogs who are napping in his barnyard. In the warm summer months, herders like Saltavat lead their animals into the nearby mountains to graze. Saltavat tells me that an animal killed one of his foals and a calf last summer. Around their bodies, there were all these big paw prints from a snow leopard. Saltavat says that just this one snow leopard attack set him back about 3 to 4 months' income. He calls this the mountain tax. Snow leopards are a vulnerable species. There may be as few as 4,000 left in the wild. And encounters between them and herders are getting way more common. Climate change is hitting Kyrgyzstan hard. The country's in a severe drought. So herders are going further into the mountains, where there's more water and better pasture land for their animals. And this really worries conservationists, because herders sometimes kill leopards when the cats take down their livestock.
If people start killing snow leopards because of human-wildlife conflict, then we can lose this population in a short time.
Kuban Jimbayev is the Kyrgyzstan coordinator for the international nonprofit, the Snow Leopard Trust. Kuban's group helps herders find solutions to coexist with leopards, like building them new animal pens the leopards can't get into. Jibayev says saving every snow leopard matters.
Even if we lose like one or two, that's a problem also. It brings problems to genetics even, you know.
So when you have a population that small, it could lead to inbreeding.
That's a really big deal.
Another thing that worries conservationists, livestock can transmit diseases to snow leopards. That includes rabies, tuberculosis, and...
Startling news tonight, a 4-year-old Malayan tiger named Nadia at the Bronx Zoo testing positive for COVID-19.
Big cats are very susceptible to COVID. Besides tigers, 4 snow leopards have died of COVID in U.S. zoos just in the last 2 months.
Clearly, snow leopards are susceptible to getting the disease and also are not very resistant once they have it.
Martin Huffman works with the UN Environment Program's Initiative to Save Snow Leopards. He says we still don't really know how likely it is that a COVID outbreak might occur among wild snow leopards. But there's strong evidence leopards could get COVID from the sort of hooved animals they typically feed on. COVID is already circulating among white-tailed deer in the U.S. 40% of deer sampled in New York and Michigan have COVID antibodies.
And that would mean that these animals, similar herbivores in Asia, could also act as a reservoir for pathogens like this and could actually pass it on to snow leopard.
At a wildlife rehabilitation center outside Bishkek, I finally meet a snow leopard. Saltanat Saitova, the woman who runs this center, nursed the leopard back to health after he got shot. He's completely blind now.
Oh my God, wow. He's beautiful.
He's got a silvery yellowish coat dappled with wavy black circles. There are pockmarked scars from buckshot all over his face. Saitova named him Basu, which translates something like my cute little leopard.
Basu, Basu. Ты пришел. Нас гости пришли. Да, да, да.
He's just rubbing his head up and down against the cage right now, just like a little cat.
Saitova says that if we're lucky, I'll get to hear how Basu meows. The meow is actually a little intimidating, but Basu is a total sweetheart. Saitova says this leopard feels emotions that are strikingly human. He acted depressed after his blindness. He had panic attacks. But eventually, Basu overcame it. He learned to be resilient. She says leopards aren't that different from humans. And unfortunately, they are also very vulnerable to COVID. For the world, I'm Levi Bridges at the base of the Tian Shan Mountains, northern Kyrgyzstan.
How did the Beatles inspire a rock revolution in Argentina? What does a poet laureate have to say about her home of Barbados becoming the newest independent country this week? How is a new cultural venue in Colombia helping former FARC rebels reimagine peace? These are some of the questions we've been asking in our reporting lately. On our website, check out the stories that hold the answers. We are at theworld.org. BAFO box office in China. Last year, China overtook North America as the world's biggest film market. China's latest blockbuster, Battle at Lake Changjin, is a propaganda film about the Korean War. It made nearly $900 million in China alone. This month, China released a 5-year plan for its film industry, and it could have a major impact on Hollywood. The World's Rebecca Canther is on the line from Shanghai to explain. So we don't have a Ministry of Culture per se in the U.S., Rebecca, so this is kind of surprising. China has a 5-year plan for movies?
I mean, this is China's Communist Party model. There's 5-year plans and 10-year plans for the country and different industries. It's a very top-down approach to a creative industry. I spoke to Michael Berry. He's the director of the UCLA Center for China Studies, and he's followed China's film industry for the past few decades. He says the plan reflects a return to stricter controls, and that's been characteristic of China's President Xi Jinping's leadership model.
Over the last couple of years, we've been seeing things realigning to those old, good old socialist core values. And this, I think, is almost a further doubling down on a lot of that. It's basically talking about more of these propagandistic films being produced.
Films like The Battle at Lake Changjin and Wolf Warrior, which came out a few years ago, also was a huge hit at the box office. Berry says that these films are getting more sophisticated in the way that they're mixing entertainment with these strong nationalistic themes.
So what is the plan?
Well, the plan includes many interesting targets. They're going to build 23,000 movie screens over the next few years. Every theater needs to have one screen devoted to propaganda films. There's also a strong protectionist tone to much of the plan. Already, there's a quota system in place on how many foreign films can enter the China market. It's 34 a year. But the new plan spells out that Chinese films need to make up more than 55% of the market. The plan seems focused on boosting the domestic filmmaking industry. The government wants more propaganda films, but it also wants to expand China's global audience with blockbuster hits. And Michael Berry says that's going to be a tough sell.
I'm afraid what we'll see is just more of the same. That is, Chinese films doing very well in the local market, making very good box office profit within China, but falling on their face internationally because they're just not going to resonate with international audiences.
So he says there's probably not going to be some Chinese version of Squid Games capturing global audiences anytime soon. Instead, filmmakers here, they know what the government wants, and that's going to impact their creative output. But I spoke to this Chinese filmmaker, Liu Feifang, and he says the focus on the domestic industry might actually be a good thing for independent Chinese filmmakers like him. He says, I think this might create more opportunities for smaller, artsier films to get onto Chinese screens.
I'm just struck, Rebecca, with how very deliberate this all is. I mean, China is an important market for Hollywood, let's remember. There are even a few Hollywood films that could be seen as specifically targeting the Chinese market, like Disney's Mulan. So what could this emphasis on the domestic industry mean for Hollywood?
Well, in the last decade, Chinese companies have really made a lot of investments into Hollywood productions, and that may go down. We're already seeing that China's interest in these co-productions with Hollywood has cooled amidst the trade war. And here's Michael Berry again.
I think Hollywood needs China a lot more than China needs Hollywood right now. They're much more reliant upon the Chinese market in order to fulfill their financial mission. A lot of that funding has been drying up. And at the same time, access to the Chinese market has been drying up or being denied completely for certain films. So that puts Hollywood in a double bind, whereas simultaneously, the Chinese market is expanding exponentially.
Rebecca, what about Chinese audiences? How on board are they with less access to Hollywood films and knowing that one of the screens in the multiplex is going to have a propaganda film on it?
Well, I think Hollywood films will always be popular in China. But high ticket sales for films like Battle at Lake Changjin show that these propaganda films are getting better at appealing to Chinese audiences. And I think those audiences actually already are accustomed to streaming pirated versions of Hollywood films anyways. So if they want to watch Hollywood, they're going to find a way to do it.
There was Rebecca Canther in Shanghai explaining China's new five-year plan for the Chinese film industry. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
Thousands of migrants remain stranded in Belarus. They came there from countries thousands of miles away, like Afghanistan and Iraq, hoping to make it across the border into Poland and the European Union. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, the EU is proposing new measures that would make that even harder.
The European Union says the situation along the Poland-Belarus border is improving. Ylva Johansson is the EU Home Affairs Commissioner.
I think we are now in a situation of de-escalation. We have seen more or less a stop of the inflow of new migrants to Minsk.
Even though the number of migrants heading to Belarus has gone down, Johansson announced a new set of proposals for EU members. Right now, migrants can only be held in detention centres for 4 weeks while their asylum claims are assessed. But now the EU wants to increase that time to 16 weeks for three states that share a border with Belarus. Johansson says this will help them to process asylum claims more effectively.
It will give the opportunity for Poland, Latvia and Lithuania to have a longer period for the registration of the asylum application.
Human rights groups say that's not going to happen. Evelyn van Homber is head of Oxfam's EU office.
What it means is that people cannot have access to legal aid, that they don't have access to health services, that they will be stuck in detention for longer periods of time, and you cannot have a fair asylum process in these circumstances.
Winter is approaching, and conditions in the camps are expected to get worse. At least 12 migrants have already died in the forests on the Polish side of the border. Van Romber agrees with Johansson on one point, though, that this is not actually a migrant crisis.
All of this is completely manageable. But because EU member states do not work together, every time something like this happens, there is a crisis, but it's much more a political crisis than anything else.
While the number of people arriving at the Poland-Belarus border in the last few weeks has fallen, activists say this has little to do with any EU policy and a lot more to do with Poland's decision to try to force migrants back across the border into Belarus. Gerald Knaus is with a think tank called the European Stability Initiative. He says EU leaders have been virtually silent on Poland's heavy-handed tactics.
So without condemning the pushbacks and praising the rapid results that have been achieved at the border, without mentioning how they've been achieved, they are pretending that this illegality is not a problem.
Knaus says Hungary did the same thing as Poland following the migrant crisis in 2015, and Europe's highest court ruled that Hungary had violated EU law. But this time around, Knaus says, the European Union is giving Poland a pass, simply to prevent migrants from getting into the EU. I ask Knaus if he thinks these new proposals will accomplish that.
No, this proposal would not stop a single person, nobody who is determined to try to reach Germany or France or Britain will be deterred by the prospect of spending a few more weeks detained in an EU member state.
And it's not just Poland that's taking a hard line against the migrants. Lithuania and Latvia are too. But Knaus points out that Poland is doing so more openly. And if the EU does nothing about it, it's guilty of going against one of its foundational principles.
If the European Commission does not take Poland to court, then the year 2021 is the year in which Europe has turned its back officially, fully and openly to the Refugee Convention, 70 years after it was signed in Geneva in 1951.
If the new proposals go into effect, it's still not certain that Poland, Latvia or Lithuania will actually process the migrants' asylum claims. And activists say EU plans do next to nothing to ease the humanitarian emergency that's still playing out on its eastern borders. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Finally today, Yemen. The United Nations and the United States are trying to broker a truce in the war there. 7 years of fighting have killed tens of thousands of people and pushed millions into hunger. Today, the war is centered on the city of Marib. Houthi rebels who now control much of the country have the city surrounded on three sides. My colleague Carol Hill spoke recently with Peter Salisbury of the International Crisis Group about the situation there and generally across Yemen.
Peter, can you give a quick description of the Yemen conflict?
Sure. So the simple story is that it's a war between the Houthis,
a rebel group from Yemen's north who took over the capital in 2014, and a coalition of Yemeni forces backed by a Saudi-led international or regional coalition, which supports the president who was ousted in 2014-2015, Abdul Rabu Mansur Hadi.
Let's go to Marib. Why is the fight over this city so fierce?
Marib's important strategically, economically, and symbolically. Strategically, it's the major base for what's left of the Yemeni army that's fighting against the Houthis. Symbolically, it's the last major urban stronghold the government has in the country's north. And then economically, right next to the city are oil, gas, and electricity production facilities that the Houthis could tap in to make their model of governance more stable and effective, and the loss of which would destabilize the government further. And the government's already facing a major economic crisis in its areas.
Until recently, Marib was the place Yemenis fled to escape fighting. New reports are saying people are now fleeing Marib, going into the desert. What is the threat to civilians in Marib?
What has happened in the fighting around the city so far is that the Houthis have taken the road going west and the road going south, and they're now closing in on the roads going east. A lot of the people in the city seem to be making the decision that they'd rather get away when there's less obstruction to movement than wait for the fight to arrive in the city.
So they're daring to just go into the desert?
I think so, yeah. There are people for whom the fear of the Houthis outweighs fear of going into the desert.
What's the US's interest in all this?
That's a really challenging question for American officials right now. There is a strand of thinking in Washington that says that all the US needs to do is pressure the Saudis enough and the war will end. But the reality is, if the Saudis left the war tomorrow, it's fairly likely that we just see even more fighting between the Houthis as they try to expand territorial and local forces on the ground, along with some localized truces. At the same time, the US certainly doesn't want to embroil itself further in this conflict, so it's kind of in a catch-22.
We hear a lot about how intractable this conflict is, that the warring parties inside Yemen and the outside parties who support them still think their own side can win. Is that an oversimplification?
I think the problem is that a lot of people, myself included, to be completely frank with you, for a number of years have said there is no military solution to this war. But shifts in the balance of power over the past year and a half increasingly suggest that it might be possible for the Houthis to win, or at least certainly win the war for Yemen's north, which taking Marib would effectively end. So we're moving towards an end game of sorts for this phase of the war, and the question then becomes whether or not they decide that it's worth trying to press the advantage and try and take over the rest of the country.
Peter Salisbury there, senior analyst for Yemen at the International Crisis Group in New York, speaking with the world's Carol Hills. The World broadcasts from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.